Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Nobel laureate Harold Varmus, President and CEO of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, discusses the public's right to access the results of publicly funded scientific research. Dr. Varmus's lecture is the Arthur Allen Leff Fellowship Lecture at Yale Law School for the 2006-2007 academic year.
I personally was a somewhat latecomer to this revolution and spending my time either running or doing science or running institutions and not paying as much attention as I probably should have to the changes that that information technology was making possible in the way in which we deal with the culture of science or the culture of many other activities that our nation undertakes. My own introduction to this occurred as a result of a conversation in San Francisco with a former postdoc associate, a guy named Pat Brown, a professor at Stanford, who had recently learned about an enterprise started by a physicist named Paul Ginsberg some years ago, who set up a site on the internet called Archive, A-R-X-I-V, for preprints from physicists, computer scientists, mathematicians, with the idea of allowing scientists to look at each other's work before publication in a totally free way. And this inspired us, Pat and I, to think about how we could bring the internet to play a much more prominent role in the way in which information is transmitted among scientists in other disciplines, particularly biology and medicine. And what I'll be telling you today is something about how those early conversations have been transformed into efforts to both build a public library, digital-based library for biological and medical science, and efforts to change publication practices by bringing in what is called open access publication, an effort that I will describe for you in some detail. Now, we all recognize the importance of biology and medicine in our own culture and the world's culture, its relevance to health, the economy, affecting large numbers of people who benefit from what we do, and many who practice the arts of biological and medical sciences. But as I will stress, the culture of doing research in these fields differs implicitly from many other fields of intellectual effort in this country, from the arts, from other cultures that are affected by changes in information technology. And what I will try to do is to give you some brief schooling into the way in which our own research community works, why the changes that we can all envision have not happened as quickly as possible. And I'll try to do this by talking first about the library, second about publishing, and I'll try to compare the ideal, the best possible library with what we actually have, and the best possible publishing system, at least as I see it, to what we currently have. I have to issue a couple of caveats. Copyright will play some role in what I have to say. I am not a copyright lawyer by any stretch of the imagination. I look forward to hearing from you on these topics. Nor am I an expert in digital technology. I know something about it, increasing amounts as I get more involved in these projects. But what I'm going to try to do is tell you about real-life encounters with efforts to change the way in which we deal with the culture of biomedical science, and by talking about those real-life experiences, stress for you what I see as the underlying problem with this transformation. And that problem is basically rooted in behavioral patterns and cultural habits of scientists and publishers and has less to do with legal quandaries or technological hurdles. So the underlying thesis of what I have to say to you is the following, that while we are, of course, as a nation, as a world, still trying to absorb and to exploit the full significance of the digital age for storing and distributing information of all kinds, and for making the best possible use of what our cultures create. But I'm going to argue that the struggle, at least in my own field of expertise, is not just with, and in fact, not mainly with technology. In fact, the technological hurdles, I think, are largely resolved. methods can be improved, but the bigger battles are with human behavior as determined by cultural practices, by financial concerns, by laws and regulations, and unhappily by inherent resistance to change. Hard to begin without saying something about scientific publishing in general, and that means going back to Gutenberg. Recently saw a musical called Gutenberg in New York, and so I know that that Gutenberg made his great discoveries near the end of the 15th century. And one of the consequences of that great invention was that now scientists wrote books and published books on their own. Copernicus and many others did that. But for over 100 years after the printing press was available, there really weren't any journals. But journals hit the screen certainly no later than 1665, when the Royal Society began publishing its proceedings and made use of a system that we call peer review, in which experts evaluate work before it appears in a publication. And over the years, especially as science became a much larger activity in the 19th century and even more so in the 20th century, the numbers of journals increased. So at this point, they became much more specialized, today there are roughly 6,000 journals in biology and medicine, and of course many journals in many other fields of science. So this is a big, big industry, and the work is done by a large number, that is the work of publishing is done by commercial entities, scientific societies, this has been characterized as the ideal business for certain for publishers. Some publisher WAG has commented that this really is the best of all possible worlds. Authors give us their material for free. Subscribers pay their subscription ahead of time. We have an essential monopoly. Papers that are published in our journal aren't published anywhere else. We can basically charge whatever profits we like, and indeed the profit margin in this industry today for for-profit journals, and for many of the society journals as well, is 30% or more. And the consequence for libraries, including libraries at august institutions like this, are problematic. That is, the rates of subscribing to these periodicals go up and up. The libraries can no longer buy books because they have to buy journals for scientists who bring in grant money. This has an effect on the academic publishing process in general, because university presses can no longer buy monographs that libraries can't afford to buy because they're paying for subscriptions to scientific journals. So that's the Gutenberg age, and it's one that I think can be radically changed, in large part because the invention of the computer, the development of the internet, make two tremendous things possible. And the first is building the optimal public library, which allows everyone access to literature, and new ways to publish scientific work that allow universal and instantaneous distribution of new scientific articles. Now, there are benefits and obstacles to achieving these two major goals that will be the major target of this exercise this afternoon. And I will talk about the two goals separately, but there are some shared issues that I would point out to you in the beginning. First of all, that there are benefits to both of these goals. One is the equity of providing everyone in the world with access to information that is largely paid for by taxpayers, by the public. Secondly, the ability to do better science, because information is not only readily accessible, but can be readily used. And thirdly, overall, the cost can be reduced. One doesn't have to print and transport every paper, but instead can make one copy that everyone can access. The cost of the system must go down. The obstacles are entrenched interests, some of the norms of scientist behavior that I'll come to in just a moment, financial concerns that range from losing profits to concerns about whether the business model for publishing in an open access way will actually work. And I would emphasize again, I don't believe the obstacles at this point are technological. So let's talk a little bit about what the ideal library would be. I suspect any of you could make this list up yourselves, but let's just get clear what we think the major features of an optimal digital library would be. And the first is the most obvious, and that is providing material that has been the discoveries of scientists, the ideas and articles written by scientists available to as large a number of people as possible. In legal terms, this is equity. The inspiration for this comes, I think, appropriately from one of the first librarians, Antonio Panizzi, who wrote nearly two centuries ago, not quite, "I want a poor student to have the same means of indulging his learned curiosity, of following his rational pursuits, of consulting the same authorities, of fathoming the most intricate inquiry as the richest man in the kingdom." And indeed, these are ideas that keep us going in this battle to put digital libraries and open access publishing in place. There is a message here that connects us to the history of books, the transformation from the medieval libraries that were privately owned and occupied by monastic orders and rich people to the 19th century invention of the public library is one similar to what I think we're going through now. We're having a conflict over digital access to the world's scientific literature. I would point out that the threat to publishers of a digital library are very different than the threats to publishers. The New York Public Library buys one book in paper, and that book is available to one person who borrows it and brings it back. That's very different from a digital library in which you make one copy, put it into the digital library, and now everyone in the world can access it. So you'll understand that the resistance that publishers feel is one that's based on a wonderful reality that the digital age makes possible, but one that has real-life consequences for publishers. So what other features do we think about? Well, we want the content to be complete. We'd like every article from every journal, and that's possible. We'd like the ability to search the full text in a variety of ways. That's something which is possible, but is improving as we learn ways to do searches in a more effective manner. We'd like the material to be deposited rapidly into these libraries, because obviously scientists would like to build immediately on information that is obtained and published. And here is where the major contention comes with publishers, because publishers recognize that if what they publish is immediately available in a library that's accessible to all, that nobody's going to subscribe to their journals anymore. And that is a very real issue. Rapid may mean after a delay of 2 months or 6 months or a year rather than immediate. We'd like high utility. The main purpose of having a digital library of this for most scientists is to be able to read the article. But there is an additional set of objectives in having the information available in digital form, and that is to try to reassort it, to mine the data for more information than you might otherwise have, than the authors have had originally perceived. So there is tremendous potential here to make much better use of the information, and that means having minimal copyright restrictions, and we'll see in a moment whether that happens. Financial sustainability is obviously important. These libraries are archives, and everybody wants to have the library live on and on, and that's something which is now achievable. So let's talk a little bit about how, to what extent these goals have been achieved. I mentioned a moment ago that the public library that of my dreams was incubated in conversations that I had with colleagues in San Francisco and NIH and elsewhere. And when I was in my final year as the head of the NIH and feeling more daring than I might have felt in the first year I was there, I proposed in a series of memos that I sent to the scientific community something which is called eBiomed, a way of having NIH generate a public repository of all published scientific information that could be accessed and and used by anyone anywhere in the world. After a series of debates with the scientific community and discussions with people at the National Library of Medicine, like David Lippmann, who was the major computational engineer in this project, we established something called PubMed Central, which is the first and until recently the only large-scale digital library for biomedical science, created as an extension of a utility called PubMed, which is used by millions of people every day to look for articles by author, by subject, by abstract. And but this was an expansion housed, as is PubMed, in the Library of Medicine's National Center for Biotechnology Information. And the difference from PubMed, which has only authors, titles, and abstracts, is that articles placed in PubMed Central had the full text of the article, which could be fully searched. The articles that were deposited there were and are mainly primary research reports as opposed to reviews and commentaries. They could be accepted up to a year or more after publication in order to encourage journals to submit their articles, even though they might, in principle, run the risk of losing subscribers as a result. At present, this repository contains nearly a million articles from over 300 journals, and some journals have placed their entire historical archive in PubMed Central. The cost is certainly quite reasonable. It costs NIH about $35 for each article that's placed in the repository, and they're happy to pay it. On average, the research that goes into every article in the biomedical sciences averages about $200,000, so $35 is a very reasonable fee for getting that work into a library that everybody can search. And now there's a similar archive that's opened in the United Kingdom as a result of developments I'll mention in a moment. And the UK PubMed Central serves as a mirror site and one that also has an expanded repertoire. And indeed, PubMed Central continues to grow for reasons that we'll come to in a moment, that is pressures from funding agencies for journals and scientists to deposit their information and the growth of the open access journal movement. But there are some very serious deficiencies with PubMed Central, ones that we hope to rectify over the next few years. The first is that if you'll recall that there are roughly 6,000 journals in the biomedical sciences, having 300 in the repository may seem like an impressive number in the abstract, but as a fraction of the total, it's small. And there are well over 90% of journals that are not included, including many that you've all heard of, like Nature and Science and Cell and others that are not willing to provide their content to the repository for reasons we'll come to. There is still only a small fraction of the articles that are in PubMed Central released copyright restrictions in about roughly 50,000 out of the nearly a million articles come from journals in which the authors hold copyright and the use of the information is granted under a Creative Commons license. So instead, most articles can be read, of course, but can't be freely used for many of the purposes that would be very beneficial. In general, the journals provide their articles 6, very commonly 12 months after publication in order to reduce the loss of subscribers. And we can discuss this in more detail if you like, but monitoring of use of journals by scientists suggests that scientists look at journals by browsing through them only for a couple of months after publication. So I would argue that that journals could quite safely provide their content to PubMed Central within, say, 3 months of publication without significant loss of subscribers, at least if the journal is any good. In many cases, the journals haven't provided their older volumes, either because they're unwilling to, and they hope still to garner fees per article, per view, from these articles, and in part because the older articles have simply not been scanned digitally to allow the digital library to accommodate them. Now, an important feature in building the public library is getting support from funding agencies. the funding agencies are perhaps the our best resource, because those are the bodies that pay for science and have the goal of promulgating science, being sure the science they pay for is most widely appreciated and best used. And indeed, many of the agencies, especially the Wellcome Trust, the Research Councils of UK, a number of other funding agencies in Europe, have been quite have firmly espoused the notion of a digital public library, and have told their grantees that there's a requirement now to deposit research articles that were based upon work supported by those agencies within 6 months in the newly opened PubMed Central of UK, with presumably an exchange with our PubMed Central. So this has been a real boon for the movement toward a more complete digital library. I regret to say that the NIH, where this whole thing began, has been much less vigorous in trying to get its investigators to provide their content either through the journals in which the work is published, or by personally posting the last edited version of the article in PubMed Central. And the NIH policy, which was prompted by report language in a House Appropriations bill a couple of years ago, simply requests that investigators deposit their work in PubMed Central within 1 year. And for a number of reasons, this policy has been relatively ineffective, in part because publishers, not just for-profit publishers, but also publishers, scientific societies that publish work, including cancer societies, have written letters to scientists saying, you don't have to do this, it's a nuisance, it might be the paper that goes into PubMed Central may be a little bit different from the paper that's published in our journal, and we prefer you not do this. There's also been fairly aggressive lobbying by the American Publishers Association, with the hiring of a mad dog, Tom Tenzenhall, who has told the APA to lie if necessary to be sure that their message gets across. So these have been some of the reasons why NIH grantees have shown quite poor compliance with this request. Roughly 4 to 5% of articles published by NIH grantees that were not published in journals that already provide content to PubMed Central have been placed in the library, and that's really unfortunate. There is the prospect of sterner legislation. Senators Cornyn and Lieberman have a bill that's been in Congress for about a year that would require agencies that spend more than $100 million a year to require grantees to post their work in public libraries within 6 months. There is also the prospect that when we have a real appropriation bill, unlike the continuing resolution that we had this year, that there will be statements from some of our more populist congressmen urging that NIH actually make a requirement, as now the British funding agencies have done. So we're hopeful that public policy will be strengthened here, and I do think it's incredibly important that if we're going to build a library that is truly effective, that we get agencies in this country and not just in Europe behind this movement. All right, so I've told you what I'm going to tell you about libraries, what an ideal library might look like, how far we've come with PubMed Central and PubMed Central UK. Now I'd like to turn to the other part, a part which in some ways has been more difficult and more controversial for some in some ways, and that is the effort to change publishing practices per se, as opposed to just having papers taken from conventional journals and placed in a digital library. That is the topic of open access publishing. So I would argue that the changes in publishing are not simply a matter of doing what technical advances make possible. And this is a reiteration of a theme I laid out for you in the beginning. In fact, in an even more powerful way than do library practices, the slow changes in publication practices reflect the culture of science. Now, this might surprise you. After all, publishers who make money control deposition of articles in the library. And that threatens subscriptions. In contrast, scientists who decide where to publish and hence influence publishing practices dramatically have little or no financial incentive to determine whether their articles go to one place or another. However, you have to consider the role the publication plays in the life, in the career of a scientist. That publication, perhaps a little like the appearance of a law school professor in a Supreme Court case, is the final phase of any successful research project. It's the way in which our work becomes known, the grounds on which we are hired, promoted, honored. And I would argue because of the importance of publication in the life of a scientist, especially in the biomedical sphere, the whole enterprise has become distorted because of an increasing belief that the value of a paper is not only correlated with the journal in which it appears, it is actually significantly determined by where it appears. And that's reflected in the obeisance given to what are called impact factors, numbers assigned to a journal based on the number of times the average article in that journal is cited in other publications. I hear my colleagues and postdocs and students talking about publishing Cell, Nature, and Science papers as though the name of the journal should be used as an adjective. This CNS format is my version of central nervous system disease. It's become a substitute for reading. I see colleagues at promotion meetings counting up the number of papers people have published in journals they respect, as opposed to reading the damn articles and seeing whether there's anything significant in them. So, this is another part of the story, but it's one that I think scientists need to counter by insisting that their colleagues be recruited and promoted based on what they've actually done, by focusing on the most important work and not counting up the numbers of papers published in these prominent journals. And then, of course, the situation is aggravated not only by this intense cultural bias, by the attitude of publishers, both the for-profit sector publishers and society publishers, that have a very strong interest in the revenues that are derived from keeping the status quo. So, as we did before, let's think first about what an ideal mode of publication might be in a digital age. And I think we can all agree, regardless of the kind of journal we publish or the business model that's used, that the digital world allows for better format and content. Indeed, one of my colleagues, Tom Pollard, just showed me some beautiful movies he's made of act and structure and function in cells, and being able to put beautiful pictures like that and movies of cells undergoing incredible molecular events into a journal article through online publishing is a tremendous advance. And these are actually not biased with respect to the kind of publication strategy that's used. Having the digital mechanism for publication allows full array of methods, full citations, linked citations to public databases. All kinds of new things can be done as a result. However, a more radical change is that we can use electronic publishing, in which we take one copy and put it somewhere and allow everyone in the world who's got an internet connection to see it, is a radical change. And that's a change which affects me in my role as someone, another phase of my life in which I'm concerned about making science a global activity, because I do agree with Ismail Sarageldin, who's been one of the great orators on behalf of promoting science in the developing world, by pointing out that science can help to feed the hungry, heal the sick, protect the environment, provide dignity in work, and create space for the joy of self-expression. And yet, the chances of becoming a scientist in a developing country is 1/100th the chance of becoming a scientist in an advanced economy. And that lack of opportunity to master science and the rich new technologies, as Sarageldin says, will accentuate the divide that already exists between rich and poor. And one obvious benefit of publishing in an open way that allows everyone to see work is that in countries like Zimbabwe or Mali, where I've spent some time, or other places, the great one of the great obstacles to effective scientific work can be overcome, namely by providing instantaneous access to new discoveries. A third feature of electronic publishing is the ease of placing the work into a digital library like PubMed Central. There is an advantage in electronic publishing, as you'll see, to having the author retain the copyright rather than simply cede the copyright to the publisher, and to make use of licensing to the publisher under the Creative Commons agreement, which allows free range of use as long as proper attribution is provided. If you were going to make an optical electronic publishing system, obviously you have to have financial sustainability. And that has to be a different model than the business model that currently obtains in the publishing industry. And what that means for most of us who are trying to practice open access publishing is paying costs in other ways, because there are real costs in reviewing and editing and publishing. And those, we believe, as I'll mention later, can be covered by fees from authors, by ads, by other forms of fundraising, including philanthropy. And finally, electronic publishing opens up a world in which the transmission of information, the exchange of information among scientists is radically different from what was true with conventional journals, whether on paper or electronically. And that is that in the digital world, it's possible to have much more post-publication evaluation and discussion by allowing readers who are reading information on the internet to post their responses and get exchanges from the original authors. And I'll come back to that in just a moment. Now, several of these are the defining features of what we call open access publishing. That is instantaneous free access, authors retain copyright, immediate deposition in a public library. Other features of the optimal publishing goals can be achieved within the traditional system of subscription-based publishing. So before talking about why we don't move to open access publishing, it's probably worth saying a couple of things about the principles of publication science. Some of these things I've alluded to already, but just to get ourselves clear about how we operate and what the objectives of the various constituencies that influence publishing might be. First, I'll remind you that doing science is much more expensive than publishing it. And we estimate that online publishing, on average, will cost about $1,000 to $2,000 per article, plus a tiny bit of money to put it into the digital archive, as opposed to roughly $200,000 to do the research. If you don't publish your work, it's basically worthless. And therefore, we would argue that asking science agencies or individual scientific groups or institutions to pay the cost of publishing is not unreasonable. It should be part of the cost of doing research, and most obviously paid by the funders of that research. It's a 1% to 2% fraction of the total. Second, we have to remind ourselves that authors don't have a financial stake in this. They may have a reputational stake, but they seek, all of the scientific authors I know are seeking an audience. They want a lot of people to read and cite their articles. They're not looking for financial returns. And we differ from writers like my wife, who was a journalist, or some of my colleagues in this room who've written novels or other books that they expect to have financial returns from. Third, the public is paying for a lot of the research that gets described in these journals. And shouldn't anyone who paid for the work have access to it, whether they're school teacher or an aspiring scientist in public schools, or someone whose relative has recently been struck with a disease about which great deal of research is being done? Shouldn't everyone have access and easy access to that material? And then we all know that the whole enterprise works better if people can retrieve all the information relevant to some scientific issue from a digital archive. So let me just quickly then, and given that framework, give you some sense of the constituencies involved in trying to move toward open access publication. First, we have to deal with the ambitions of authors who want prestige, who want to be read and cited. they want to feel their article goes to a place where, to a journal where the quality of review is high, where the style is good. The scientists who read want to be able to see the information easily. They want to have confidence in the quality. They want to believe they're reading the important journals, and they want the information to be relevant to their own topics of interest. Publishers are concerned about building a great reputation, about having a sustainable effort, a good business plan. Many of them would like to make money, and they'd like to be public servants. And then many other people who were involved, libraries and institutions like Yale, or disease advocacy groups, just taxpayers, the scientific agencies, want the system to work well, and they want the cost to be as low as possible. And some of these, but not all, are those that predispose to open access, but you can see there are many others that are basically neutral. And because of the essentially conservative nature of our enterprise, some of these, such as the prestige of journals in the Cell Nature Cell category, restrict the movement toward open access publishing. Now, there is a very broad range of activities out there among the 6,000 journals, ranging from the one end, for-profit publishers like Elsevier, who have very high subscription fees, who make an effort to sell even lousy journals by bundling them together with prestigious journals and requiring institutions to buy the whole package. They make over 30 to 35% profit margin. The copyright always resides with the publishing company, and contents are not placed in the public library. At the other end of the spectrum, we have the open access publishers, who do all the things that I've described earlier. And then we have a lot of journals in between, some of which are subscription-based and provide their content to PubMed Central, many society journals, and so forth. Now, I'd like to try to talk about how far we've gotten to the ideal of open access publishing by saying a few things about one example of open access publishing, namely the Public Library of Science. This is an organization that began in 2001 by Pat Brown, who I mentioned earlier, Mike Eisen and I, an organization that began to advocate for deposition of scientific articles in PubMed Central. But when we saw that this was happening slowly and that the interest of the scientific community in what we were doing was, despite 30,000 signatories to a pledge that we all made to only provide our services as authors and editors reviewers to those journals that complied with the request to deposit their articles in PubMed Central. Still, we felt the only way we were going to be able to demonstrate the virtues of open access publishing was to do it ourselves. So we went to the Moore Foundation, received a $9 million grant to start some journals. We put together a team, including professional editors we hired away from journals like Cell and Nature and Science. We said we would deposit our articles in PubMed Central. We wanted to make Public Library of Science a brand like Nature, Science, and Cell that would be appealing to our conservative scientific colleagues. We had great peer reviewers, and we established two flagship journals that were intended to demonstrate the credibility of open access publishing by producing journals that were truly outstanding. And these two journals, PLOS Biology and PLOS Medicine, launched in late 2003 and 2004, have been big successes. Here are some pictures from PLOS Biology, which has a very high impact factor, whether we like the impact factor or not, one of the highest in the industry, is clearly a journal in the top rank. Major visibility in places like the New York Times or Synopses that appear in Nature and Science and elsewhere, and covers a broad range of biological science from ecology to evolution and many other areas. The medicine journal is very similar in design, addressing a large number of topics, particularly many topics that are relevant to global health. Since then, we've started a series of community journals, all with the same principles. These journals are an attempt to imitate the success of the very best society-based journals. And our journals so far in genetics, in computational biology, in microbiology of the sort that causes disease. We're about to start another journal with the help of the Gates Foundation called Neglected Tropical Diseases next year. And the big experiment that I'd like to mention to you briefly is a much more inclusive and high throughput effort called PLOS One, which we just launched a few months ago. All these journals, of course, can be seen by any of you, and those of you who have found this, the wireless is available here, but you can go online and see any of these journals right now. But PLOS One is the true experiment. It's the most innovative thing that we've done at Public Library of Science. We've developed new software to allow faster reviewing and faster publishing. Covers all topics in biology and medicine. The articles are reviewed, but they're reviewed for scientific method, not for the importance of the results. So if the work is done properly, we don't care if it's viewed by editors as being more or less important than the average paper that appears in Cell. It's just we try to provide a high acceptance rate for all those articles that are done in a credible fashion. And then we provide opportunities for readers to post next to every article a comment, another piece of data that might be worth thinking about, simply an evaluation, is this good or bad, and an opportunity for authors to respond. We also are attempting to make the PLOS One site the go-to site for any scientist in any given day, entering through a portal that's specific for one's discipline, seeing advertisements for meetings or for scientific materials. We've even talked with Jamie Boyle about the possibility of having ways to click through to get material transfer agreements signed and with quick transfer of materials, a burden on many who are trying to obtain materials that are described in published reports. So this is an adventure. But there are still a lot of unsolved problems in efforts to make open access publishing a more vibrant industry. For one thing, we need still greater support from funding agencies and, in particular, acceptance by the scientific community. Many of my colleagues say, yes, open access publishing, great idea, and still send their best work to journals that are completely uncooperative with the process of making what we do a truly public activity. And that bothers me because we should be endorsing and acting on our endorsements of this movement. One way to do this is not simply to create new journals, but to have the existing journals begin to offer an open access option. And that's happening increasingly, so that article by article, one can pay an extra $1,000 or $2,000 and have one's article immediately placed into PubMed Central. You can continue to hold the copyright. And many journals are now doing this, especially as a result of the Wellcome Trust requirement that all articles that describe work published supported by them is in a public library. And then we have to demonstrate that our models, our financial models, are self-sustaining, they actually work. And that's been probably the biggest source of anxiety. Public Library of Science, of course, has spent a lot of time thinking about our model. I don't have time to go into this in detail, but I can tell you more or less how we operate. We require authors to pay a fee. We do allow exemptions for those who come from poor countries, simply don't have a lot of research resources. People come from certain fields like ecology, where grants tend to be quite small. But the average cost is quite minimal, $1,250 for publication in PLOS One, up to $3,000 for the flagship journals. We expect over time that the dramatically increasing volume of articles that go into this large encyclopedia, PLOS One, will compensate for the costs of publishing our expensive journals. Journals like PLOS Biology and Medicine reject over 90% of the articles submitted to them. Though the transactional costs of reviewing are high, and we acknowledge that we're spending $10,000 or $12,000 for every article that's published. We don't charge that much, so we have to make that up in the volume of publishing from other sources. We're doing advertising in a variety of ways online. We have large donors helping us at the moment, but in the long term, we expect to switch to a different kind of model where we have many more institutional individual memberships, where we have a model that operates like National Public Radio with people who appreciate the value to them of having scientific work in the public domain, willing to give us $5 or $50 every year. Let me pose to you two final questions. In the audience, there are both readers who are scientists, readers who are not scientists, authors who are scientists, and there are two questions I'd like to end with. First, do you want to go through life being told every time you ask for an article on the internet that you pay either $9.95 if you do this before January 2006, or now $20 or $30 or $40 to see each article? Or do you want to see articles actually made freely available to you through open access publishing? And finally, I would say to the scientists, are you doing everything that can be done to make what you do with public money available to the public that seeks the information? In this famous painting by Rembrandt, Dr. Talp is shown exhibiting his knowledge of anatomy to burghers from nearby towns in the Netherlands, and I'd like to think that my scientific colleagues share the same sense of civic pride and civic devotion to the promulgation of scientific knowledge. Thank you very much.
This lecture was recorded March 26, 2007 at Yale Law School.